Conscious Living and Power Radio. Hi there, I'm Wendy, and it's already that time of year. Holidays. Do ghosts have any activity during the holiday? I don't know. More activity? I don't know. However, I do know that Paul Ramosh, who has a book, Fingerprints and Phantoms, might have a connection to some ghosts and some unexplained paranormal activity. And it probably happens 24/7. At least that's my experience. I don't know if that's, you know, if that's different when you're doing it as an investigative reporter or an investigative forensics person, if there's any kind of a theme or a pattern. But Paul might know that, and he's got a book to prove that it isn't just people like me who experience this stuff. It's everybody. And Paul, I'm so glad you're taking notes. You liked campfire stories, and that kind of kicked this into gear. Is that how you were attracted to, you know, asking your coworkers about personal experiences with ghost encounters?
Yes, that's correct. It's great to be on with you tonight, Wendy. I appreciate you having me. And yeah, ever since I was a little kid, I've loved stories. And I mean, if you think about it, stories were probably the human being's very first form of art, basically, or entertainment or whatever. We have been a storytelling race for a long time, and I love it. And so, yeah, when one of the things I enjoy about my job as a crime scene investigator and working in law enforcement is that it's a This business, law enforcement, is a very rich storytelling occupation. There's a lot of downtime that we have. And it's funny, when you watch forensic shows on TV or cop shows or whatever, there's always action and there's always running and chasing and shooting and all these things. But in the real world, there's a lot of downtime. And so that downtime can happen because you're waiting for a search warrant to be signed, or you're waiting for the transport people to come pick up a person who's dead to take them for an autopsy. That can take a while, or you're waiting for this and that. And so in that downtime, there's always a lot of stories that are told. And so that's one of the, like I said, that's one of the things I enjoy about my occupation, is all the ample and plentiful stories.
Well, and you, I mean, some of this it's kind of gruesome. I mean, we're talking, this is the crime scene investigation. You've been doing this I'm looking at your bio just to make sure I get the dates right. you've worked since 1997,
right,
for the Weber Metro CSI. Okay, this is in Utah.
Yeah, and it's funny, I've been doing it so long, some of our interns and students now weren't even born yet when I started. That's how old I am.
Reality check, yeah.
I know, it's awful.
So you get to be the wise old soul everybody goes to say, is this real? Am I sane?
That's true, yeah. And you know, experience, there's virtue and experience and wisdom, right?
Hopefully. Hopefully.
That's what we tell ourselves. When you look at the mirror and see the wrinkles and the balding head, you're like, I have experience. I am good.
I've done something. See, look, it's written down.
Yeah, that's for sure.
A part of this, though, is that when you're getting into the paranormal, and especially when you have a reputation or you have credibility, sometimes it makes people a little bit uncomfortable that they're sharing things that might make others question that reality. And I think I'm hoping that will expire, that attitude and those kinds of ideas about this will eventually, you know, become extinct. Because
yeah,
this is, you have right now the cases in front of you that say that these things happen.
They do. And it's been interesting. It's been an interesting road as I've put this book together and then got it published and, you know, talk to people and get out there. A lot of people have questioned, well, how can you, someone who supposedly is dealing with science and fact and evidence, talk about and believe in the paranormal things? And I mean, my answer to that is always that there is something going on that people are experiencing. So, I mean, the concept of ghosts, they go back as far as recorded history. There's stories and traditions and different things. And so for all of the human experience, people have been witnessing or experiencing something. Now, who am I to say that all of them are wrong. Now we can look at some experiences that people have, and it's funny. I'm actually kind of a skeptic, and you know, I don't use skeptic the way some people do, that I don't believe anything, but I don't believe everything or every story I'm told. I'm a little skeptical, and so
yeah.
You know, if you look at ghost, you know, people's ghostly experiences, you can dismiss some of them as a noisy building or a creak in the floor or something. Like you can dismiss some of those as misidentifications. You can dismiss some things that people witness because perhaps they're on drugs or they're having hallucinations or something. You can dismiss some of those, but there are always a percentage of them, and it could be large or it could be small, but there's a certain percentage of things that people have witnessed in the paranormal realm that I cannot just readily dismiss. I cannot say it was a misidentification, and I cannot say that they are hallucinating. Something happened to them. And one of the stories in my book that is really kind of illustrative of that was a case that I worked when I was just kind of a rookie. It was one of my first really gruesome crime scenes. And the stories in the book, and it was bad. It was a really bad. It was a young wife and husband who were going to split, and it was pretty amicable at the beginning, but then it turned sour, and he ended up murdering his wife. And like I said, it was a gruesome crime scene. But when we started going, when we were working the scene for a week or over a week, we could feel her presence when you walked into the room. Like when you walked into the room or the apartment where this happened, you were not alone. And it's just a feeling. Maybe it was all in our heads, whatever. But it was so kind of real to us that we would greet this deceased victim by name when we would walk into the room. Like you could feel her.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, we worked the crime scene. It was, you know, it wasn't a whodunit. It was the husband, and we knew it all along. But, you know, you have to go through the documentation stages and preserving the evidence and, you know, get the case all shored up.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one of the big differences between TV and reality is most of the time on murders, you know who did it. It's not a whodunit, but it's a howdunit kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, we had a lot of work to do, but then, you know, we were done, and the case was handled, and the perpetrator went off to prison, and, you know, we'd kind of forgotten all about it. Well, it was like over a year later when one of the officers who had been there on scene with us, he was actually one of the first responders who actually found the victim, he responded back to that exact apartment over a year later for something completely unrelated. So it had been renovated and re-rented out, and some new people were living there. And he responded to the scene for, it was a noise complaint or a juvenile disturbance or something minor that people just had to create a police report, and they weren't in trouble, but they had to report something. So he goes, and when he walks into the apartment, he kind of has a flashback of what he had seen the last time he was there. And, you know, so he was on edge a little bit and a little bit affected. That's one of the things with PTSD that they're discovering.
Yes.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is you have flashbacks sometimes. And so, you know, he was kind of reliving what he saw, but he was, you know, doing his job and he was okay. Well, at the end of this little official bit of business that they had to do, the woman living in the apartment said, "Hey, officer, I have a question. Was somebody murdered in these apartments?" And at that point, Mike, the officer, he, you know, felt kind of the hair on the back of his neck stand up, and he's like, "Well, yes." And she goes, "Well, can you tell me which unit the person was murdered in?" And Mike's like, "Well, are you sure you want to know?"
Mm-hmm, yeah.
and she said, "Yes, I'd like to know." And he said, "Well, I hate to tell you, but this one, she was murdered in this apartment." Well, the woman's husband or boyfriend, whichever, was sitting on the couch watching TV. And he goes, "Oh, that explains a few things." And then he just went back to, you know, his watching TV or whatever. And so at this point, Mike can feel kind of the color drain out of his face. You know, he can feel the blood drain out of his face. And he's, but he can't just leave it alone because he's really curious. And he's like, why do you say that? And the people, they didn't seem that disturbed, but they're just like, well, sometimes the bathroom door will open by itself and the light will turn on in the bathroom. And they talked about a few other little minor things, but the main thing they focused on was the bathroom door opening and the light turning on. But they didn't seem that worried about it. And, you know, Mike was a little bit freaked out by the whole thing, but he went on his way. And the reason this story is important and the reason the different details were important and why it fits into that paradigm of things that I can't dismiss is that unbeknownst to these people and unbeknownst to everybody, really, except for those of us who were there at the scene, the bathroom door was a very important part of what happened in this case. So what we figure happened is he was chasing her down the hall and she was trying to get into the bathroom, but to get away from him. Well, the bathroom door opened outward, and so she got sandwiched against the door, and that's where she met her demise.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people recounting that story, they are basically saying specific details about this crime that nobody knew. It wasn't in the papers. It wasn't on TV. Nobody knew that that bathroom door was a crucial part, and that's where the tragedy unfolded. Right there. And so this belongs into one of the category, to make a long story short here, or a short story long, this belongs in that category of these people, through their paranormal experience, had specific knowledge that they would not have been able to get otherwise. And so, and it seems like our deceased individual here was trying, you know, in death, she was getting that door open, which she could not do in life, which might have saved her. And so, like I said, this belongs to one of those where, well, yeah, there's a story here, and maybe we could say, oh, it's the air conditioning or the faulty wiring or whatever. We could kind of dismiss it, but there's specific information here. And as an investigator who's been trained to follow the evidence, I can't dismiss it. You know, I don't know what's happening necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I can't dismiss that this is happening to these people.
Well, and I think that is the important part about this. The book is called Fingerprints and Phantoms. And again, my guest is the author, Paul Rimash. And this is True Tales of Law Enforcement Encounters with the Paranormal and the Strange. When you're talking about being a skeptic, I appreciate the fact that you're meaning that as a discerning individual, more or less trying to just make sure you've got all the facts before you jump to the wrong conclusion. And I think people who are really serious about investigating and trying to figure out what's going on with these events have that attitude of, let's not assume. We have to have some of these issues laid out before we can draw any kind of a conclusion. And even then, you're not always going to have the answers. But sure, this little piece of the puzzle where your officer there is experiencing a little bit of that post-traumatic stress, and then to have somebody he's never met who shouldn't know any details give them a very crucial piece of the puzzle is mind-boggling. And
right.
I think, you know, again, this is a testimonial of somebody experiencing something firsthand that says, what else? Something's going on here. Something's going on.
Yeah. And the way I collected the stories, and it's, you know, important for your listeners to understand about the book, is I'm not trying to, this isn't a paranormal investigation book. This is a collection of fun and ghostly stories. So I in my book, I'm not trying to make any sort of judgment or conclusion about what these things are, because I don't know, basically. But they're fun stories that will take you on a fun ride. But yeah, if you're looking for, you know, the ultimate treatise on what ghosts are, you know, it's not this book. This is for fun. This is campfire stories, like you said in the beginning. And so, but yeah, there's multiple multiple stories that kind of fit into that realm of me not being able to dismiss it. And another story that I think really fits well into that category is the first part of each chapter of the book, I kind of talk about, I call it CSI or law enforcement insider information. So the way the chapters are structured is I talk about different aspects of my job that aren't necessarily paranormal, and then they transition into the paranormal stories. And so a lot of the people who've written reviews really like the book the style, because you learn a lot about CSI and you also hear some fun stories. But one of the chapters, the first part of the chapter talks about eyewitness testimony, that it's a very crucial form of evidence in law enforcement, that most cases aren't made with forensics and fancy lights and all this stuff, but it's people identifying the perpetrator of the crime and testifying in court that they saw different things. And eyewitness testimony is very important, but eyewitness testimony can be faulty. So people can have kind of faulty memories. If multiple people get together and witness the same event and they all saw it a little bit different, kind of the strongest personality in the group can kind of talk the others into seeing things the way they did. And
yeah.
And so you eyewitness testimony is important, but you have to handle witnesses correctly. You have to quickly separate them, lock their stories in before they have a chance to compare notes, so they don't
muddy the water.
Muddy the water, have their accounts morph into a single account. And so, yeah, it's very important for officers and detectives to manage that. Now, that being said, and how this applies to the story is one night a mother and a daughter were driving down one of the main thoroughfares in our area called Riverdale Road. And it drives through this part of town where there's tons of Walmarts and Applebee's and shops and car lots. And, you know, it's all kind of a business district, but it's a big road, one of the bigger roads and busier roads in Weber County. And so it goes over the interstate or two different interstates at some point. So there's some big bridges that go over I-15 and I-84, I think. Yeah. So anyway, this mother and daughter are driving down Riverdale Road, and it was a dark evening. There wasn't a lot of people out and about. It was a little bit stormy. And when they got to one of these bridges going over Riverdale Road, they looked over on the side of the road and they were shocked to see a young woman dressed in just kind of a light t-shirt and gym shorts, you know, not even very long shorts, standing on the side of the road with one leg over the concrete barrier. And she had her face in her hands, and she looked like she was sobbing. And so, you know, they see this and it's shocking because they know that over the other side of this barrier is a 30 to 40 foot drop to the interstate below. And, you know, seeing the girl, how she was dressed for that time of night and the weather, and seeing that she looked emotional, they thought something's not right here. We better see if she needs help. So they quickly pull over past her. And when they get out of the car and look back to where she was gone. And so their initial thought is, oh my goodness, she went over. You know, in the time that it took us to drive, you know, 20 feet, she jumped over the edge. So they walked down carefully. They looked over the edge, expecting the worst, to see this broken body down below. And there was nothing. So at this point, they're like, we better call the cops. And so they call the cops, and the Riverdale Police Department shows up, and they tell them what happened, and they go and they shine their lights down over the edge, and they can't see anything as well. Now, where they were at on this bridge, the only option to after you go over that barrier is a straight drop. There's no ledge. There's no embankment. There's nothing. They're just, you go over that concrete barrier, you're down on the interstate below. And so the cops, like I said, they look, they shine their flashlights all around. And finally, they kind of sigh. And one of them says to the other, see, I told you it was the ghost. And at this point, the mother and the daughter kind of look at each other, and they're like, whoa, what do you mean? And the one officer who told me the story said, well, I hate to tell you this, but this is the fifth call we've had in the past few months describing the exact same thing, describing the same girl, same clothing, same attitude of, you know, look like she was sobbing, and the people drive past and they look over and she's gone. And so she's like, yeah, is this the fifth one we've had? And so we've kind of, you know, we're just kidding, but we say it's a ghost. So the mother and the daughter are like, oh, kind of freaked out, but then they go on their merry way. Well, so the officer tells me this story, and I'm like, well, so has there ever been a suicide? Like, or something on that bridge that this might be the actual ghost of? And she's like, yeah, not that anybody can remember. And, you know, so they're not really sure what's going on. But where this is important from that point of view of we can't easily discount this, remember when I said if you have eyewitnesses that are separate from each other and tell the exact same story and they haven't had a chance to compare notes or talk each other into a certain narrative, if those people are separated and have the exact same story, that is considered to be extremely reliable evidence.
Yeah.
So what do we have in this case? We have five different motorists who don't know each other, have never met probably, and they weren't there at the same time. They were stretched out over the span of weeks, and they are telling the police the exact same story each time. How can you dismiss that? It meets the perfect criteria for excellent eyewitness testimony that you would go to court with any day of the week. And that's what we have here.
I have a question. Since there's no correlating story or anything that they know of that has happened before in that spot, right?
That particular officer did not know. And she had been there she retired from there, so she had 20 years. But who knows? You know, we're not really sure. But as far as we know, we couldn't tell any. There's no correlation.
My question is it a precog? Is it a precognitive event saying this is going to happen? Because that's also a possibility.
Sure. And to me, that's one of the whole time skip kind of element of the paranormal to me is very intriguing. In that, you know, when some people see something, like you said, is that something that's already happened and that's the spirit of that person? Or, is it something that's going to happen? Is it something that did happen, and it's not necessarily that person's ghost or spirit reenacting that, but it's just a moment of time that's been recorded there somehow? So,
yeah.
I mean, there's no way to really know. But it's these people saw something. Their stories match perfectly. How can I just say, oh, no, that's nothing. They're drunk or, you know, how can you do that?
Right.
You can't.
To me, it's a cry for help. Now, and that comes from a different, you know, different perspective, intuitive, saying, okay, something, the fact that you, and most, the general public won't have access to this kind of information for the most part, but when you do have access to it and you start doing some questioning, it's like, okay, there's a cry for help. Where is it coming from? And is this a potential to say, this could be changed, and then the scenario would then dissipate. It would have to be repeating. So that's where you get into more of this other element that you're not covering in your story, but I really like it because you raise the questions. How's that?
Yeah. Well, and that's, like I said, this book isn't there for answers. It's there for the story.
I want to get back into the one of the stories that an officer told you, and this has to do with, you know, everybody has this opinion that cemeteries are the best place to go because they're always haunted and there are always weird things happening there, and that may or may not be true. But the officer in your story tells you a story, and then at the end, I love the response. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, yeah, you go ahead and fill in the details on that. I'm just glossing it over, but I like his attitude at the end because you don't expect that.
Yeah, it's funny. So in Ogden, Utah, we have one of the older cemeteries in the state. So, and it's pretty big too. There's a lot of the first pioneers to this area from the 1840s are buried there, and, you know, and then on up, and there's even some celebrity, well, not really celebrities, but the voice of the mirror in Snow White. He's buried over in the Ogden Cemetery.
Uh-huh.
So some Mormon apostles are buried over there and stuff. So it's a cool cemetery. And it's actually, I could, from where I'm at, I could throw a football into that cemetery. It's really close to where I'm at right now. It's really close to my house. But
okay.
So there is one of, in the cemetery, there's one of those graves that is like graves or cemeteries that you've heard lots of stories about where there's kind of a reoccurring ghost and nobody's really sure about what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this grave is called, it's Florence, and they call her Flo. And so nobody's really sure how she died. Some people say she was killed by a car or in the Spanish flu epidemic or some different things. But it's the place that all the kids take their girlfriends in high school to scare them, to spook them.
Okay, hold on. Wait. On that happy, dramatic note, we're going to take a quick break because we have to come back for the rest of this story. Fingerprints and Phantoms. And this is Amazon, anywhere you can find it. It's available. Kindle, True Tales of Law Enforcement Encounters and the Paranormal and the Strange. And I will also, this is an interesting one with the cemetery ghost. But just coming back to what's up with the evidence room. Okay, so in the next half of the show, we'll talk about that evidence room quirk. Things that make you go, And thankfully, these are people with credibility who are saying, yes, this stuff happens. Back in a few.
Every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news that she has breast cancer. And here are some of the first words she hears. HER2 new oncogene, aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? This is Olivia Newton-John. As soon as you get your diagnosis, you can go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options. Prepare a list of questions for your next doctor's visit and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
As a young teenage boy, I didn't even know what autism was. How do you even spell that? A few years later, I heard that a friend's cousin's son had been diagnosed with autism.
I still wasn't sure what that really meant.
When I went to college, my roommate's brother had autism. When I moved to the city for work, my best friend called me and told me his son had been diagnosed with autism. We were both in shock. I still remember the day I walked into the house and saw that look on my wife's face. I knew something was wrong. I'll never forget how I felt when she said, "Our son has autism."
Autism is getting closer to home. Today, one in 110 children is diagnosed with autism. That's a 600% increase in the last 20 years. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Hey, Mom. Why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Thank you. Fingerprints and Phantoms, that's the name of the book. Two tales of law enforcement encounters with the paranormal and the strange. My guest, Paul Ramosh. And the thing is about Paul, that he is a writer, and he also is a trainer for police officers and crime scene investigators. Okay. And he likes campfire stories. So that's kind of how this came together. But for one thing, just having the longtime experience with these kinds of encounters gives you, I think, an edge, because you've probably heard a lot of stories just, you know, all off the cuff. But it sounds like maybe that appearance on George Norrie triggered this.
Yeah, there a lot of, you know, once you get it out there, it opens so many doors. And I think so many people in law enforcement have experienced things that they don't understand, but they're really hesitant to talk about them. But yeah, as soon as they can tell that you're serious and you're not going to make fun of them and that you'll listen, then the floodgates just kind of open. So yeah, that was a great kind of impetus for me, and a lot of good stories have come in since then, for sure.
Okay. I wanted to say that just because if you're listening and you have a story, Paul is open. He's working on more books, we think.
Right. I would love it if you have a story, especially if you're in forensics or law enforcement, to reach out to me on my Facebook page for the book. So in Facebook, it's Fingerprints and Phantoms. And yeah, if I would love to hear more stories.
Okay. We're going back to the cemetery showstopper here. This is the one, you know, where the kids who think they've got, they might know a thing or two, go and get frightened. And
yeah.
And think, okay, all right.
It seems like every big old cemetery has kind of some legend about it, that, and all the high school kids, you know, that's their place to go get thrills. And in the Salt Lake Cemetery, Salt Lake City, that's the biggest and oldest cemetery in Utah. And there's a place called Emo's Grave in there that if you go and touch this vase and say certain things, you'll see stuff. But, cause I grew up down in the Salt Lake Valley, and Ogden's 50 miles north of there. So, but in the Ogden Cemetery, there's Flo's grave. And so, like I said, if you go there, you're supposed to, and flash the lights of your car, you're supposed to see different weird things going on. And so I've, you know, since the book has come out and I've talked about Flo, I've had other officers who have seen a lot more. Some of them have seen what they thought was a full body apparition. Some people saw candles flicker on that they thought were extinguished. And so there's been a lot of weird stuff that's happened here. But this chapter, like I said earlier, each chapter kind of talks about law enforcement insider information. And one of the reasons a lot of things happen to officers in cemeteries is they go to quiet places to write their reports. So if a police officer just parks in any old parking lot to type up their reports, get caught up on a few reports, people will come and ask them questions or, you know, have fix-it tickets or different things. And so they don't mind talking to people, but if they need to catch up on their reports, they want to go someplace secluded. So in the middle of the night, a lot of them will go into a cemetery or a back alley or something to get away from people so they can get caught up on their paperwork. Well, this one officer that you're referring to, and he's a very good officer, I always enjoyed working with him. He's since retired, but he was in the Ogden City Cemetery one night getting caught up on paperwork. Well, he looks up and he sees, it's kind of hilly there, and so he sees over a couple little hills this kind of neon blue mist rise up over the hill. And so that's one of the things that supposedly Flo will manifest herself as, is this blue mist. And so he sees it come up and over, and he looks at it and goes back to his report, and then he looks up a minute later, and it's a little bit closer. And he goes back to his report, and then he looks up, and it's still getting closer to him. And finally, he, you know, gets done with his report and then drives away. And so he tells me this story, and I'm like, oh, gosh, that's cool. Like, were you scared? You know, you were seeing Flo. Were you scared? And he's like, well, no, I wasn't scared. I don't believe in ghosts. I'm like, oh, okay.
There you go.
Well, you saw a classic Flo, but I guess if you don't believe me, you don't believe.
Yeah. Well, and see, that's part of it. Sometimes that's just like a way of keeping your reality in the known zone, where you don't have to worry about these things that make you question. It's like, nope, don't believe it. Not a problem. Doesn't exist. Carry on.
Yeah.
Now there's another guy there, Larry, you talk about. And Larry was no holds barred. He saw the ghost, and the ghost did something different.
Yeah, and I think that's the one where the candles flicked on, I think, when he saw, I'm trying to think, because I have several different officers who've told me the flow story.
Yeah, it was the candles.
Yeah.
They sprang to life.
Yeah, he was there, and people will put different candles and little votives on there, and all the candles were extinguished, but all of a sudden, he saw them spring to life.
Poof.
And there's like, no real reason for them to, you know, they weren't out, or, you know, there wasn't any sort of ignition source, but all of a sudden the candles popped on. But yeah, there's flow's freaky, and
a lot
of people experience stuff.
Okay. Now the evidence room, I think that is the other fascinating part of this. And that's why I'm not a real big fan anymore of estate sales or of places where there are a lot of stuff with excess baggage hanging around that I decided I don't need to bring that in my home anymore.
Yeah.
So the evidence room is one of the things that is a star for you guys as well. There's things happen there.
Right. And it's interesting. So I couldn't help putting these, you know, as I put these stories together, to notice certain patterns. You know, like I said, this isn't a treatise on the paranormal. It's a campfire romp. But there were certain patterns that developed as I talked to people. And one of them seemed to be, and this isn't just our agency, but a lot of different people I've talked to, even from different states, that there seems to be a lot of weird things associated with evidence rooms. And as I've thought about it and looked at it and analyzed the story a little bit, it kind of makes sense, because it seems like people or the spirits or the energy or whatever you want to call it, they seem to be attached to their property. And for us, In our evidence room, like if we have a homicide or something really, really intense like that that happens, we have to bring some of the evidence back to our room. And sometimes we have to dry the blood on it and then repackage it. Or sometimes there's different processing. Like, we don't store evidence long term in our facility. We just store it long enough to do what we have to do. Well, it seems like whenever there comes into our office or something like that, there evidence of a homicide or something like that, then there's this spike in weird activity, whether there's noises or dreams or there's orbs caught in infrared photography or just different things that happen that are kind of weird. And then they go away once we return that evidence out of our office. And so there does seem to be just this link. And like I said, I don't know what it is, if it's a spirit, if it's energy. You know, a lot of the stuff we collect on violent crimes, there's the actual blood, the actual tissue of the person on the clothing, and we need to dry it. And so perhaps that's associated with it somehow. But it's, yeah, there seems to be a link, and it's not just us. Kind of all over, you hear different stories of weird things happening in evidence rooms. So I don't know. It's a fascinating thing.
One of the pictures in your book is a drawing here of it looks like a tree with a couple of things coming out of it, fingerprints and phantoms. And this is in the chapter that talks about a blizzard of papers.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. So that picture was drawn by one of a small child, friend of the family. He drew that. Supposedly a haunted house, and he drew that for me and gave it to me one day, and I liked it so much I had it put in the book. So it's not necessarily related to that story, but it's
well the thing that it is that the kids in this talking about children, a boy and a girl, seeing the kids, and there was no place for the kids to go. were the guys in the building wanted to find out why the kids were there. Remember that one?
Was it the city and county building? Was it in that blizzard of paper?
It's page 45. And it's, he was on his rounds going up to the second floor.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
okay.
That's in Salt Lake City. One of the most beautiful buildings in the whole town is called the city and county building.
Okay. Yeah. That's what it is. A dash. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a really old building, really magnificent architecture. And unfortunately out here in the West, they would knock down old buildings and build new buildings more mm-hmm. readily than save old buildings. It's pretty tragic. I know back east, they handle things a little better. And then in Europe, they really do a good job of preserving their old buildings. But out here in the West, this building's kind of old. But they didn't do that with the city and county building.
It's old. See you, bye.
It was built in it's 20 years old, knock it down. But fortunately, the city and county building was preserved. And so it's a beautiful, beautiful building downtown. But that place is haunted as all get out. There's stuff going on there.
Which is why sometimes you knock things down. Okay, let's get over that. All right, so here we go. Yes.
Maybe they should have. And so there's multiple stories in there. And so the one you're referring to is they have security guards that go and make their rounds at night. And a lot of weird stuff has happened to these poor guys. Kind of my favorite story is from the city county building is one officer completed his rounds, building's locked, there shouldn't have been anybody in there. He went into the bathroom to take care of nature. Mm-hmm. And while he's sitting in there, all of a sudden, just the door to the bathroom just slams.
Oh.
And just as loud as can be. And he's, as far as he knows, he's alone in there.
Yeah.
And so he, quickly finishes what he was doing and gets himself buttoned back up and grabs his gun and runs out there and looks around and nothing's there. Doors are still locked. And the one you're referring to is they saw, once again, it's night, doing their rounds, see a boy and a girl there that shouldn't be there. And when they go to investigate, they're not to be found. And it seems like those, when you see little kid ghosts or hear little kid voice, ghostly voices, that seems to be the really weird thing. That's really creepy.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're more scary than an adult ghost, but it seems like they're terrified.
Well, you never know what kids will do. Adults, you've kind of got them figured out. Kids are like, true. Anything's possible.
Well, kids normally can be scary, right?
That's right. Well, that's what I'm thinking. Okay, so though, this is the fun thing about it is that there's a wide variety of these stories, and there's just that way. It's not just if you like a certain kind of ghost story, that's not it. But you also have at the end, there's a photograph or two. So is this photographic evidence?
Well, the photo you're referring to, and I wish it was printed. I wish it was a little clearer. But the photograph in the back of the book is very interesting because it was taken with an infrared camera. And so there's lots of applications in forensic science for infrared cameras. You can see blood on dark colored clothing.
Mm-hmm.
It'll change the dark cloth to look lighter and the blood will stay dark. And so we use it a lot to look for blood at crime scenes. And infrared will also make certain inks disappear. And so you use it for forgery and document cases. And then it'll do several different things. And so we had the infrared camera out to photograph clothing with blood on it on a homicide case. Well, just kind of messing around, I rear up and take a picture of my coworker, Shanae, with the infrared camera. And in the background, and you can barely see it in the book, but the picture was a little bit better. In the background, you could see four weird, they weren't classical orbs in that they were round. These were more oblong shaped, but mm-hmm. they were right over her shoulder. And I looked at the picture and I'm like, what the heck? And, there was nothing, no reflections going on. But just with the visible visible eye or the naked eye, and I looked through the camera and I couldn't really see any, you know, there wasn't a flare, lens flare coming in from anywhere. Like I couldn't necessarily explain where these four shapes came from. And so, you know, I'm not saying, well, look, we captured a ghost here or whatever, but it's one of those things that I can't explain. And it's funny because this ties into the whole concept of evidence and even some of the other concepts in the book, that Shanae was working on a homicide case, the one we had the camera out for, that where a young woman was killed and there was weird things that happened in her office while the evidence was there. It seems that the spirit of this young lady followed Shanae home, and her husband saw her in a dream one night. And then we have this weird anomaly on the infrared camera, and it's my understanding that ghost hunters will take out infrared cameras, and supposedly they can see some stuff with it. And so we just had this kind of confluence of weird events, and once the evidence was returned from this case, kind of some of the weird stuff in the office stopped happening. And so it, you know, I'm not saying, oh, this is her spirit and she's doing this and this and this. I'm drawing no conclusions here. But these things were happening. Like Shanae was experiencing these things. The anomaly was in the camera. Her husband experienced something. I can't just exclude it. I can't.
Well, and I think that one's fascinating too, because of her home experiences and the husband, you know, what? Dragging him into this.
Yeah.
Sorry, dear. Whoops.
Well, and that was the whole concept of a spirit following someone home from a crime scene is kind of what really launched this whole project and really launched my interest in it, because it appears that from time to time, an investigator will go to a scene of a violent death and that the spirit will follow them home. And I have two different accounts in the book. There's another one that I didn't put in the book. So like the book really isn't a true crime novel. I tried to leave the details about the crimes extremely vague. I didn't want to profit or people's profit off of people's misery, let's say. You know, I mean, I see, you know, the victims, and I try to work for them. I try to have respect for them. And so the stories that I tell are really vague, and some of the best stories that I could have put in the book, I couldn't think of how to make them vague, so I left them out. If there was too much detail that a person could easily read the story and say, oh, I know who exactly that is, I left it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, out of respect for the victims, you know, the stories that are in there, unfortunately, the patterns repeat over and over again. And so, you know, you can't read one of the stories in there and assume, you know, exactly what I'm talking about. But you know, that being said, there were some other examples of ghosts following people home that I couldn't use, but it seems to happen. That for whatever reason,
yes,
that spirit will attach themselves to an investigator. Maybe it's because they're trying to help them. Maybe because they reach out psychically to them somehow. I don't know. Once again, I'm not making any conclusions on this, but they seem to follow them home.
Okay. From my experience, sometimes if somebody is a little, you know, psychic, intuitive, whatever, they can pick up on what that spirit is trying to imprint on them and maybe do a better job of solving the case or at least following through on the case. And then once the business is concluded, the spirit then dissipates, moves on, dissolves. But a lot of times, just, and you know, in my own experience, this is a residual energy. And if you are open to it, I had a friend who went to a museum and she knew there was a spirit there and she invited the spirit to go home. Well, that what happened then was the daughter asked mom in the car on the way home why the person in the back seat smelled so bad. And mom learned very quickly that you don't just invite some, you know, anomalous thing that's attaching itself to you home to visit.
Yeah.
Because a girl saw it. She didn't. She felt it. She felt it like it held her hand. You know, she felt that, but she didn't see anything. And then when the child identified it, she decided maybe she needed to reconsider what she did. But I've other things, you know, a person came to me after his son was killed and asked for help. And there was a certain amount of evidence that was being discussed, and the dad was wanting to go in John Wayne. And at that point, the son was involved in some things that were extremely dangerous. And if the dad did anything, he would be putting his own family at risk. Those kinds of things you can pick up on as an intuitive, but it isn't something that, you know, and in that realm that anybody in law enforcement is going to take seriously unless they have their own experiences. So right there, you've got the person, that the deceased, who is having access to someone who may be able to connect a few dots. And in some cases, they can imprint an answer, a suggestion, a prompt of some kind that might help somebody who's living connect the dots. That's my opinion. So yeah, that's what I bring to it.
And it's interesting, in the first story that happened to my dear friend Mitch, he was a young investigator at the time, and he went into the scene where a mother and daughter had been killed by the daughter's estranged husband. And he was alone in there at some point, and you know, there was other people there at the scene. We were all there, but you know, because of the ebb and flow of different activities, you might find yourself alone with the bodies. And so Mitch was there, and he knelt down in front of the younger of the victims, and he said, just as a mental exercise, you know, he wasn't expecting an answer, but he just said this to help him in his own thought process. He said, okay, tell me what happened to you. And as soon as he did that, the lights went out in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't tell you how long they were out. It seemed like an eternity to him, but as soon as they popped back on, he was a little shaken, and then he came out and he's like, hey guys, did you notice the lights go out? And we were like, no, nothing happened out here. And so he went back about his business. But then after that, he started to notice a lot of weird things happening around his house. And one of the weirdest things that was going on was his dog. He had a pug. Named the dude, and his picture's in the book too. We kind of dedicated the book to him because he passed away, unfortunately. He was kind of an old dog, but the dude started to act very strange. His eyes and his head would track like he was watching somebody walk through the room, but nobody was there. He would look up on the ceiling, and like he was watching something floating around the ceiling, and nothing was there. He became obsessed with water, especially in one of the bathrooms in Mitch's house. He would always go bark at the toilet, and just all these really weird things happened. Well, one day Mitch started to date a new young lady, and she was an intuitive. And so the second she steps foot in Mitch's house, she's like, you've got a ghost in your house. And Mitch is like, what? And so, you know, kind of by process of elimination, talking about some of the different things, the girl, his lady friend, figured out that it was this spirit from this crime scene who had followed him home. And, you know, as best we can tell, he opened himself up to her by asking her that question. He let his guard down, her spiritual defenses or whatever, and she latched onto him and followed him home.
And she didn't know where else to go.
Yeah, he was talking to her. He was there to help her. Tell me what happened to you. I want to help you. You know, whatever. He reached out to her, and yeah, like she had just been betrayed by someone she had loved, and she latched onto Mitch. So it's fascinating.
So what did he do to clear it? Did she just dissolve, move on?
No, you know what? She stayed, and the dog and everything still went on until he moved. Like, she never left.
That is what's fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay. Fingerprints and Phantoms, that's the book, True Tales of Law Enforcement Encounters with the Paranormal and the Strange. And this is a book, a lot of different variety in here. And again, you've done a good job of keeping it. This isn't meant to exploit anybody, but these are true crime scenes. in the best possible way, keeping the evidence private, giving people an example of what might happen and why you shouldn't be too afraid to have this stuff go on, because it happens to everybody. If police officers and, you know, crime scene investigators are having it happen, then we know, okay, there's something going on here. I really am glad you're telling these stories.
Thank you. I'm glad I'm telling them too. And it does give people an outlet. I had an interesting experience a few years back where we were having a forensic conference around Halloween, and we were hosting it at our agency. And so a lot of people had come up here to Northern Utah, and one of the nights during the week, we were having a little banquet. And so the organizers knew that the book hadn't come out yet, but they knew that it was in the works. And so they asked if I could come in the spirit of Halloween to tell some stories. And so I said, sure. And I went and, you know, they had a mic, and I put together a few little pictures to show them some stuff and told the stories. And when I was done, the person who was emceeing said, hey, you know, does anyone else have anything that's happened to them? We'll pass the microphone around. And none of the tables, there were probably 60, 70 people there. Nobody was willing to share a story with the group about something that happened to them. So they're like,
we
got to
go.
Thanks.
We got to go.
Oh, darn. But
I know. It's we're going to have to just continue, you know, put the story on Facebook.
All right. Well, read the book.
That's right. That's right. Fingerprints and Phantoms. Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much. Nothing like a cliffhanger. Thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks for having me. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Thank you.